Thank you. Thank you very much for the warm welcome. In the Kyugo language, we always begin by saying skano sogwego. That's really extending to you wishes of wellness and hope that you're well and all that are with you are well. And sogwego means to all of you. And so that's just a short greeting that we use. It is indeed my honor to be here. The trip here was a little bit scary. And I hope it's not scary going home, or maybe I'll have you bunking with one of you folks tonight. Before I get started, I know we're here to talk about compassionate justice, but I do have to acknowledge that many people in the Indigenous community right now, they're in a time of grief. There has been a court decision that has really triggered anguish among many people. And my friend Delia is here today, and she said, it's a good thing we're together in this place at this time. I wanted to read a post from someone that I admire and I look up to. He posted this on his Facebook page yesterday, and this is from Murray Sinclair. He said, today I grieve for my country. I grieve for a family that has seen only injustice. From the moment a farmer with a handgun, question, why does a farmer need a handgun, killed their son. I grieve for a mother who saw the police raid her house and treat her like a criminal and not the victim she was. I grieve for other mothers and empty arms who are reminded of their loss at the hands of others and lack the answers that haunt them still. I grieve for the youth who now see no hope and whose hunger for justice gives rise to anger. I grieve for the children whose lives now have one more jeopardy. I grieve for the elders who've seen this before and whose wisdom holds no means to get through this evenly. I may grieve for some time, but then again, we've been grieving a long time. That is why we can't just get over it and move on. My country won't let me. And another lady that I know from the community, she's very involved in the traditional community of Six Nations of Grand River. She posted this comment. When faced with such inexplicable injustice and wretched racial hatred, we must continue to speak our language, sing our songs, use our medicines, dance our dances. This proves we are still here and connects us to the unmistakable resilience of our ancestors. And that gave us more of a positive note. So ordinarily when I gather with the people of the Haudenosaunee people, we open with an address called Gnohanyo. And it's in English, it's basically means the words that we say before anything else that we do. And it can be a long address. It can take up to an hour and a half. So I'm not going to do that. But I do just want to explain the context and the reason for the protocol. Gnohanyo is a speech. It's not necessarily a prayer that you might think of in your way, and those who pray from the Christian faith, but it's a protocol of expressing our place in the universe. And it starts by saying that we're going to bring our minds together and dwell on one thing. And even though we all come with different things that we carry, right now, at this moment in time, we've come to talk about compassionate justice and what we can do about that. So in my own way, I'm kind of taking you through Gnohanyo and reminding you that that's why we're here. And I know we all have other issues that we have to deal with. And I just reminded you of the bigger, broader one that's very active in the minds of many Indigenous people right now. And that's the decision with the court case. But we also can turn our minds to positive things. And so today, hopefully, that's what we can do as we gather today. I am from the Six Nations of the Grand River. It's about an hour and a half drive on good days. It's about 3 hours on days like today. I'm a member of the Tuscarora Nation. So this was not our traditional territory in the beginning of time. The Senecas did live here and occupied this area for a while. You'll sometimes hear Six Nations people referred to as Aboriginal. We heard that term this morning. First Nation is quite in vogue lately. Indigenous is in vogue. The people from my community, they refer to themselves as Haudenosaunee. That refers to the people of the Longhouse, which was originally the dwelling. And if you come to my community, you can actually come and see that we're reconstructing a traditional longhouse, which was the traditional, I call it the mall, it's the first condominium. And you go inside, you can see it. You can see it. So you can come and tour that, and there's a young man who can explain that it was a place of dwelling for the community. It was a collective place of dwelling where the clans lived together. By a clan, each one had a longhouse. In today's activities, the longhouse really is a place where people go to conduct ceremonies now. It's become more of it's not a church, but it's kind of that, serves that function, a place to gather for the sacred things that have to be maintained. So my people, the Six Nations people, we came into what's now called Canada from the United States after the War of Independence. Some of our people fought on the British side, some fought on the American side, and those that fought on the British side came north after the War of Independence. So we're settled along the Grand River, which is, you probably know of Brantford and Caledonia, that river that goes along that way. The tract of land that we were assigned, it's called the Haldimand Proclamation of 1784. Our people call it the Haldimand Deed. It was from 6 miles on either side of that Grand River from source to mouth. And then in less than 10 years later, the tract of land was shortened by the Simcoe Patent, and it didn't go all the way to the source. So that's still under dispute. So right now, our territory, our acknowledged territory, is 10 square miles. And I'll have a visual and I can show that tract of land. Compared, and now we have this little postage stamp that we occupy. But if you want to look, just Google Haldimand Tract or Google Global Solutions, and you'll see that picture that shows what is now the land that we occupy as compared to the land that is in the deed. So when we talk about compassionate justice, we need to understand sort of the context within which we're trying to do things. And I talked a little bit about one incident. But for us, like even today, governments and cities, towns and families are claiming ownership over lands that were never sold, that were leased and never paid for. That's even today. And even today, the Six Nations of the Grand River, we still seek compensation for that tract of land. What happened to all those lease monies if they were ever paid? And looking for an accounting of the trust funds. Some of those trust funds were used to fund things like McGill University, King's College at University of Toronto, without the knowledge of the Six Nations people. So we're just looking for an accounting of that. The actuaries that have looked at it have said, there's no way that the country of Canada can give you a cash payment for what that amounts to. So if you want to go look at the Global Solutions document, you'll see that there's a win-win situation, we think, there. We're not looking to dispossess people of their homes or anything like that. So we're still trying to resolve those outstanding things. That's one big broad layer of the context within which we try to achieve compassionate justice. You may have heard about all the murdered and missing Indigenous women. That's still ongoing. And the inquiry into it is also opening up wounds that people are still trying to deal with. My colleagues, our institution, Six Nations Polytechnic, we are considered an Indigenous institution because we're established by our nation. We have brother and sister institutions all across the province. And the ones in the north especially are trying to deal with the trauma of finding children murdered, find them in the rivers. This is happening today. More broadly, we see things like in society where now it's been documented that Canada's prisons are now the new residential schools. You know, we left the residential school era. Mind you, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has given us calls to action to try and address, and we're still dealing with that trauma. But now we're seeing our people incarcerated at extraordinary rates. where our population is only 4% of the national population, 36% of the incarcerated population are Indigenous women, and 25% are Indigenous men. And if you factor in the federal prisons, the overall incarceration rate for Indigenous inmates is 22.8%, as compared to 4% population. And I see people shaking their heads, and I do too. So there's a huge amount of work for us to do. And so thus the calls to action. You know, in the Globe and Mail recently, there was an article last year also about another area that sort of tells us and understand the context what we're dealing with, about Aboriginal children making up a disproportionate number of children in foster care. This was in 2011, the stats came from. For the children 14 years of age and under, they represent 7% of the population of the country. But when it comes to looking at the children in care, they're almost half of the percentage of all the children in care. So 7% of the population, half of the population in foster care. It's just absolutely mind-boggling, the systemic issues and structural issues that we have to attempt to address. You may have heard about the name Cindy Blackstock and the Caring Society and the Canada Human Rights Tribunal decision about the inadequate funding and the underfunding, actually the discriminatory funding to Indigenous First Nations child care agencies. And that decision was made in 2016. And it was just this week, or last week, I guess, on February 1st, that there was another ruling, the latest decision, that not only was it found to be discriminatory, the government was ordered to take action to address immediate needs around funding mental health services and First Nations agencies, and to reimburse First Nations, those that have tried to cover those services, those critical services, by taking it from someplace else, you know, in an already underfunded area. So that's another sort of indicator, if you will. I don't want to bring everybody down. I just want you to really get a full grasp of, you know, the contextual, the structural, and systemic context within which, you know, we have to try to do something that's going to make a difference, a long-lasting difference. And then we talk about today, you know, we talk about the decision, the acquittal of Gerald Stanley, you know, in the death of Colton Bushy. It's just triggered all kinds of, I would call it negative energy among our people, and people are struggling to find a way to move forward. I myself wasn't surprised by the verdict. We are in our community have had two young men shot, and in both cases the shooter was acquitted. So it didn't come as a surprise to me. I'm not saying I'm happy about it, but I'm not surprised, because there are clearly systemic issues that have to be addressed. I'll just read you one of the quotes from some of the people that were reacting to this decision yesterday. And this particular person is a law professor, so legally trained in the Western system. The comment is, colonial justice system is inherently racist. I'm not mincing words. Killing of Indigenous peoples has to end, and the privileged system that protects white men needs to change. And that's pretty raw language, you know, to read on a Saturday morning. But it gives you an indication of where people's hearts are and their minds are. So now that I've sort of set that context, we are here to talk about compassionate justice. And one of the things I've learned and what I've been taught, and some of the wise people who've worked with me, they said, when you're faced with these kinds of things, you just need to make the decision to stand tall and carry peace. So that's why I'm here. Plus, I'm looking for allies always. Let's look at the education challenges then. I'm here to talk to you about the Indigenous Institutes and how we have a unique capacity to make a difference in this context. Our learning is grounded in our indigenous ways of knowing and living, and so we can facilitate the four, I call them the four R's of reconciliation. Recovery from a lot of the trauma that was in the past and still ongoing. Revitalization of our languages and our knowledge systems and our ways of conducting business among each other. Restoring respectful relationships with others and among ourselves even, because there's huge issues in communities because of the trauma that have been experienced. And the fourth one, the most important one, is reciprocity. Doing this through reciprocal relationships with others. And that's one of the other reasons why I'm here today. You may have heard about the education gap, the education attainment gap, we call it. If we look at the scope of Indigenous peoples not having the same level of education as others, it was back in the year 2000, I know it's getting dated, but the Auditor General then said it would take 20 years to close the education attainment gap of Indigenous learners. 20 years. And then factor in all the child welfare stuff, all the incarceration, everything else that's going on. So, you know what I mean? There's just in education alone. Frighteningly, in 2011, 11 years later, that has grown to 2020 to close the gap with the progress that we're making to date. So, why is that gap happening and why is it getting stronger? Even today, 150 years since Confederation, an intimidating path to the nation's colleges and universities have left thousands of Indigenous people with no education qualifications at a rate higher than any other population in the country. So what obstacles are on that path? We have had a huge population growth within our communities, and there was an imposition of a 20-year cap on funding to support students to go to post-secondary. That was put in place in 1996. And based on a $300 million cap on spending per year, the average drop in students being funded was approximately 2,700 per year. My community is a community of 26,000. So our percentage of that is quite high, because I can tell you that I used to work where we funded students through the federal funding program that was capped. And our budget was capped in 1996. There was a time when we could fund 700 students for tuition support and some living allowance support. And then over time, because of that cap, tuition came up. So the number of students went down to 400. And that's the inverse relationship, and that's what happens when you have those kind of dynamics that you're dealing with. So the participation rate dropped and not keeping pace. The second major obstacle that we faced is being prepared to have a chance of success when elementary and secondary education is failing the majority of our Indigenous students. In my community, every year, we send students, about 100 students out to high school under a tuition agreement. And so they attend the public schools. And we count ourselves lucky if we can see 30 of those students graduate at the end of 4 years. That's pretty dismal. But we've inserted an interrupter. We've inserted another track for our students. I'm going to talk to you about that after. But what happens when this trend continues? Across the country, we have a growing population of adults without secondary school and with the skills to be able to continue their education and maintain employment. There are many examples of this. For example, the Saskatchewan Indian Institute of Technologies, this is 2012, their annual report cited 1,563 students applied for entry, Indigenous students. Of these, 612, less than half, were accepted. And of those 612, 36% graduated. That's not a good level of success and investment, in my opinion. The second thing that happens is that a number of young adults have been accepted into post-secondary institutes on inflated secondary school results. And what happens is they get recycled through entry program to entry program to entry program, as long as they make the count dates and the funding is paid, the tuition is paid. So this is big business. And it's ongoing even today. So if you're looking at this data, which is some of the things that I do with some of the really mundane things I do, it begs the question, how can we keep doing the same thing year after year and try and improve the outcomes? We simply cannot. It's been our experience that students are highly successful when they study in a relevant, Indigenous-based learning environment. This, coupled with adequate resources, re-engages the adult learners, and it also avoids disengaging the young learners. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about what we do at Six Nations Polytechnic, and we shorten it up to SNP. It's not quite SNAP, it's not SNP, so it's SNP. As an Indigenous institute, we do things differently. We're guided by our what we understand as our place in the world, and that we all carry a responsibility to sustain life as we know it on Earth, and that we're all interdependent, Indigenous people and non. So that's sort of like a basic principle and understanding of the worldview. And that's been carried forward, and you'll see it evidenced in our documents and in our treaties. Some of you may know of the Gaswenta or the Turo Wampum Treaty. Usually I bring the belt with me, but today I forgot it. And it's a belt that shows it's a white belt with two paths of purple. And the one path represents us, the Indigenous people, and the other path that's purple represents others. And in between them are three rows of white beads. And that represents how we sustain life, because they're parallel lines, how we sustain coexistence through interdependence. That's what it talks about. And it's maintained through peace and friendship and mutual respect. And those are in our early treaties from the early 1600s. And those are the principles that really guide our institution today and everything that we do and all the relations that we make. So at Six Nations Polytechnic, we've written down three strategic purposes. We exist, of course, to provide education to our own people, to Indigenous people, so that they can gain employment but not lose their identity. So they can maintain their identity, they can enrich their identity, they can be stronger. Secondly, we exist intentionally to close the knowledge gap that exists about us in this country. There's a huge historic collective knowledge gap and understanding gap about the true history of the country and the impact that that true history has had on Indigenous peoples. So that's one of our strategic objectives, is to address that. Thus, I am here, and this is some of the things that we do in terms of offering sessions and education to non-Indigenous people. By the way, our school is open to people of all backgrounds. We welcome that because we believe, again, that we all coexist together. We must learn to be interdependent. So we put that right through our learning environment. And our third reason that we exist, one of the things we hold ourselves accountable for, is that we need to contribute to a sustainable future for everyone who shares this land. So that eventually all gets translated into programs and relationships and partnerships and everything like that. So if you go to our website, our vision, we've stated that our vision is to achieve international distinction for education, in Indigenous education, Indigenous language revitalization, and the continuance of Indigenous knowledge. Now, some people, I have to stop here a little bit and talk about Indigenous education means it's rooted in those understandings of Indigenous perspective. So it's not that we just want to have more doctors, more lawyers, and so on. We want them to understand Indigenous thought. So that's a really key concept in the vision, of why we're distinct, why we're unique, and why we're really the only institutions that are going to pay attention to that in the post-secondary sector. Our specific mission, it's unique, and it deals with the preservation, the application, and the creation of knowledge specific to our languages and our culture, while respectfully interacting and informing other knowledge systems, going back to the Turo again. Even in our research, we articulate it as two-road epistemology and research, and that serves the social, cultural, and economic needs of our community and society. And we do that and we conduct our ways ourselves by observing what we call the values of Ganikuyo, or the good mind. And these, if you come to our school, and we have two campuses, by the way, one at Six Nations in the Grand River Territory and one in the city of Brantford, you'll see the values in every classroom, the values of the good mind. And we're all challenged every day to conduct ourselves this way. Teachers, students, board members, you know, when we're faced with challenge, we look, I'll sometimes look at the wall, and sometimes the staff will say to me, well, you know, you could have done this with that person or that with that person. And I'll point to the wall and I'll say, look at those values. With what you're suggesting, would that represent responsiveness, openness? Will I build trust if I act the way you're suggesting? We have to think this through. And so that's what we do every day. We try to do every day. So everything that we do, all our programs, we focus first of all about, let's recover that knowledge and that language information in particular. We were really blessed to get to partner up with one of Indigenous scholars who's at McMaster University and participated in a SHIRT grant. So we were able to get archives from the Smithsonian of J.N.B. Hewitt, who had documented much of our ceremonial information and our knowledge back from the 1800s. I think it was. Maybe it was earlier than that. And it was written in his way of writing, Cayuga, Onondaga, Mohawk. And we were able to get that material and we brought it back. And our elders who work with us, we call them the Indigenous Knowledge Guardians, they came in and they looked at it and they said, I can't read this. You know, so we were fortunate enough to have a Haudenosaunee scholar who's a linguist from our community. So he came in and he looked at it and he said, okay, I can figure it out. So he rewrote it in the way that we write now, but more importantly, he was able to look at it and read it to them. And as soon as he said the words, they went, we know what they're talking about. And the beauty of that whole exercise was that the knowledge that was written down over 100 years ago, maybe it was longer than that, still resonates with the knowledge carriers today. And so the practices that are in there are affirmed, if you will. It's a validation process. And then our next step as an institute is to take that information, put it into our way of writing today, our languages, put it into English, and then translate it into teaching resources from kindergarten up to post-secondary. So just that one project alone is a lifetime of work. And so that's the kind of exciting thing that we know we can do because we still have people who carry that knowledge. And so that's part of the restoration stuff that we do. In vitalization and revitalization, we are concerned about closing the education gap. We do two really critical things there. On the language piece, we teach language at the institution. We teach it at the university level. Actually, we're the only institution that has a standalone degree. We have a Bachelor of Arts in Ongohoy Languages. And we can offer it in either Mohawk or Cayuga. So students have their choice, what they would like to study. And it's the only degree of its kind, not just in Ontario, not just in Canada, but I like to say the universe. There is no other anywhere else, because that's where the knowledge is. And the reason we went and pursued getting our own Bachelor of Arts degree there, there's a process we had to go through. It's called ministerial consent. It was because the knowledge holders felt very, very strongly that the knowledge had to be maintained in the community, it had to be controlled in the community, and it would be shared in the community, it would be taught in the community under the authority of the community. Rather than, we could have gone and worked with McMaster, and McMaster could have granted the degree. But can you imagine our students going and paying tuition to McMaster to get a degree in Ongohoy languages? It just doesn't fly. So we did the arduous journey of submitting through the ministry. The ministry, it was colleges and universities back then, I think, to actually attain the ministerial consent to offer our own degree. And so that's one thing that we do in terms of language revitalization. But in the continuum of revitalizing a language that's almost disappeared, most of our languages are on the verge, we also work with everybody in our community and other Haudenosaunee communities across the country. So in our community, we have immersion programs in the language from, there were preschools, but they had to close because we didn't have funding. Right from kindergarten to grade 12, we have immersion programs. And we have adult immersion programs as well. One's really successful, the Ongawana Kanjokoa. It's a Mohawk language program. Brian Miracle has designed a way of teaching the language that really creates speakers. So we have a number of activities happening in the community on language revitalization, and we're just a piece of that. You know, so some of our students come and they've already gone through all of these and they're quite good at their speaking, but then they become more formalized in their language and the knowledge of the grammar and so on. And then they're ready for, certainly they're ready for teaching the language after that. And so that's one of the things that we do in terms of revitalization. In terms of the restoring of well-being, we've made our turned our attention to making sure we give opportunities to the young people in particular to learn about who they are as Haudenosaunee people. We offer a program called the UP program, University Program. And we partner with six universities for that. We've been doing this now for 25 years. All of the universities came forward and put one course on the table and said, okay, here at McMaster, we're going to put this course on the table. Guelph, you're going to put that one. Western, you're going to put that one. We all agree to recognize these courses, cross-credit them for credit transfer. SNP, you're going to deliver it. And when the students are complete the first year, as long as they're successful, then they get admitted to one of the six universities. So yes, it's a recruitment mechanism for the mainstream universities, but more importantly, it gives us an opportunity to work with those young minds when they first come in. We started off with older students in the what we called Native University program in the beginning. Now we call it just the UP program. Even with our older students, and we're still finding it with our younger ones, they come in and no one's ever talked to them about the history of the country, the true history of the country, the history of their people. Nobody's ever talked about that, the implications of residential school. No one's ever raised that formally in school. So when they come to us and they go through that learning experience, it's like an aha moment. So that's why we're different. Or that's why people are angry all the time. Or, you know, those kinds of things. I actually had one student say, how come nobody ever told me this before? Well, intentionally, it was left out of the public curriculum. So when they come to us, they actually experience it. And then they go through an identity discovery process. Another program that we've initiated is called the Haudenosaunee Ambassadors Program. That's just a summer school, and it's not credentialed in any way. But what it does is students had to apply to attend, and they came to learn about culture, about the values, and about how to carry themselves as they go forward as adults. And we're into our third year now, and the students have found it to be life-changing because, once again, they began to find out who they were as Haudenosaunee people and affirmed their identity. And we've also shared the curriculum, the framework for the program with partners from around the province. It was funded by the Ontario Trillium Foundation. I must acknowledge that. Thankfully, it was very well funded, and we've been able to share that across the province with the intent that we can teach the young people to then be trainers to do the same thing across the province. So that's what we're doing. Those are the kinds of things that we're doing with restoring of well-being as well. We do incidental things like lunch and learns every month, or more often than that. Student will offer a lunch and learn on the ceremony cycle. We just finished midwinter in our community. It's a major ceremony time, and our school is adjusted for the ceremony. So, you know, the instructors want to go, the students go, and the classes aren't held then. So it's a very different learning environment in what we do. So I just wanted to share that point out that the programming that we do right now, it's started at the post-secondary level. We're getting into the trades training area now, and I'll talk a little bit about our second campus. We have done research and we continue to do research. If you get to come to SNP, come to the Six Nations campus, we have what's called De Ohahage, the Indigenous Knowledge Center. And there is the beginning of our archives. We've had a number of really critical documents donated to us, and that's where the J.M.B. Hewitt collection is right now. And that's where our researchers come and they work. So we have the Indigenous Knowledge Center, and we have the archives there, and they're continuing to grow. We work with universities in the States who are providing us copies of their archives because they know it needs to be with us. And interestingly enough, one of the researchers, he was going through the documents and he said, I found my great-great-grandfather's name. We didn't know exactly what the name was, but I found it by going through this archive. So we're rediscovering those things and we're repatriating that kind of documentation back. So it's a really critical piece. So we do have that research and resource function there. We've added a fourth pillar, I guess you would call it. Recently, we launched the STEAM Academy, Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Math. And what it is it's a model that comes from the States, and it's designed to be grade 9 to 14 is the easiest way to talk about it. Is the students can finish their high school diploma and a two-year college diploma in as early as 4 years, depending on how hard they want to work, and the normal time would be 6 years. So why did we do it? Well, jump back to what I was talking about, sending 100 students out and only seeing 30 graduate. We just couldn't see continuing it again and again and again. This opportunity came to us through the private sector that has models in the States. And they said, would you like some support in doing this? We're willing to help you, not with money, but with advice and so on and so forth. We said, great, let's look at it. Staff went and looked at models operating in the States and they came back and said, you know what, we can do this, but we'll have to do it our own way because it's got to be grounded in our thinking, with our languages and our understanding, and then we'll do it that way. So we did. And without any money, we launched the STEAM Academy in September 2017. We didn't even start to recruit until May. And by September, we had 35 students, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And they're attending in our Brantford campus. And they're just having such a great time learning. Like, it's just a joy to go see these kids because they're just right into it. And they finished their last semester, they finished their first semester, and I was asking the principal, I said, well, how did they do? Because it's really challenging. Like, they focus on technology, and they're doing virtual reality stuff and coding and things I don't even understand, working with 3D printers and things like that. I have no idea what they're doing. But he said, our pass rate is, of all the courses, is 85%. 85%. And the students, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, have become the best ambassadors for the programs. Like, I have a video that I show whenever I can, and it's the students speaking, you know, and they're the ones saying, we love this place, we love how the learning is, we love learning together, and we're just going to tell the world about it, and they do. So, interestingly enough, we just had an open house this week. Thursday night, we had an open house for the STEAM Academy, and I guess they were mobbed when the doors opened. They had over 100 people come in one evening for an open house. So we have registrations almost up to 50 for this coming fall. We can only take 75 max, so we're getting a little bit worried about that. So the plan is to just build it one grade at a time. We brought in the grade 9s this year. They'll go to grade 10. By the way, they'll start to take their college credits then. The new grade 9s will come in, and then we'll gradually build it all the way up with a record of success, and those who are up there will become the mentors of the younger ones. And so that's what I mean in terms of how things would be done. So that's something that's really exciting that we've done in terms of a fourth pillar of our activity is the STEAM Academy. I think we're a little bit weak, I know we're weak, is re-engaging adults at the literacy level. We do have a literacy and basic skills service, but it's funded $100,000 per year. So if you can imagine a population of 26,000 people, there are hundreds of people out there who need literacy and basic skills development. And those two ladies who can only work part-time, you know, are really, really stretched to even begin to address the issues. So we need some serious re-engagement on the adult front. We have too much social funding dependency in our community. We're seeing issues with alcohol and drugs in particular in our community. And that's because people, their capacities are not being routed in the ways that they could be. So we've got to be able to expand what we are doing best to reach those people, to re-engage them, and then they, in turn, will be able to carry things forward. I don't want to sound like we do all this all by ourselves. Like, we work in partnership with colleges and universities all the time, and we have for 25 years. So we tend to work with those that are nearest to us, because usually it involves an access route for a student. Like, they can come and they can start year one in the university program and then go to McMaster or go to Western or go to Brock or go to Laurier, depending on where they want to go. So there's that piece, the access piece. But interestingly enough, we started to build partnerships with, especially at the college level, where the intent is to really impact, you know, strategic goal number two, understanding of Indigenous peoples. So we designed programs to impact the profession. So with one of our college partners, we offer practical nursing with Aboriginal communities. And the content, the curriculum, is clearly focused so that the graduates, Indigenous and non, will have some understanding of Indigenous health issues, Indigenous health practices, traditional medicine, and so on and so forth. And that has been hugely successful. And we hope to do the same. I've tried with social work, but I'm not getting through the gate on social work. It's a very protected sort of piece of a profession. But we in the area of education, we are accredited through the Ontario College of Teachers to offer what are called additional qualification courses. And the reason we did that was for the same thing, to impact the profession. Imagine there's teachers in the province everywhere who are teaching everywhere who have no knowledge about Indigenous peoples. You know, and so we see that as a need that needs to be addressed. So we offer what we can in that way. So that's in terms of partnerships. That wasn't really a partnership. We do that as a standalone institution, but we're certainly open to partnerships with all of our partners. But the most important thing I would say is that we did that Bachelor of Arts in the Languages. That was key to the people in the community to say, this is our knowledge, this is the way we're going to own it, and this is the way it's going to be carried on. And the fact that they support formal education to do that is a critical piece, because education, as you know, was never always a friend. You know, but now that it's been reclaimed to be useful, then it is accepted. I wanted to talk a little bit about recent events that's happened that have impacted us, and hopefully will, and I know it will impact the structure and the system of education in Ontario. Our institution, we work with other institutions like ours. So we have a collective called a consortium. You can Google Aboriginal Institute Consortium, AIC. You can find us. There are 9 of us in the province. And if you plot us on a map, we cover the whole province of Ontario. We've been working together for 20-some years and going to the government saying, you know, we can make a difference. We just support us. We can do these things. Our students are successful. And we've been, here's a little bit of money. Go ahead and run a pre-employment program or something like that. It's kind of been really incidental and informal. And in 2014, we took the bold step of saying, you know what, we need to make a major game changer here. So we reached out and we hired a very influential advisor, former Premier Bob Rae, and he came and he worked with us and we developed a position paper called the Roadmap to Recognition. That outlined what our role was, our unique capacity, because we operate based on our cultures and our Indigenous knowledge. And we documented that, all of that piece of who we are. We took it to government. We went from minister's office to minister's office to minister's office. The timing was right. And the government responded positively and said, yes, we're going to do a policy. Okay, we agree to do a policy that will somehow, your institutions will be a part of post-secondary in Ontario. We've kind of been operating on the fringe all this time, right? So that was well and good. That was good news to us. So we got busy. We got going on it. And we worked really hard in 2017. And we actually went through a process called co-creation. I mean, we sat in the room together, provincial ministry folks and our institution folks, trying to figure out what is it that we can actually put into the law or into policy in Ontario that will make sure that there's a place for our institutes alongside the colleges and the universities. Well, we ended up landing on legislation, and in December 2017, the government of Ontario passed the Indigenous Institutes Act, which didn't create us, it didn't create our institutions. What it did was say, we, the government of Ontario, acknowledge that these institutes have been established, and they've been established under the authority of their nations, and now we're going to put in place ways that we can work with these institutions. And in fact, the institutions will be considered the third pillar of post-secondary education in Ontario, alongside universities and colleges. So that was a major game changer. What it's going to mean going forward, we're still cultivating the garden. We've still got lots to grow. We've got lots to do. But an important piece about that is that we've also made the provision in the legislation for an Indigenous accreditation process. So SNP, our intent is to become a university, to operate as a university. Our community expects it. They want their own university to convey our knowledge and perpetuate our knowledge. And that's the next path I'm on, is the university status. I'll just back up a little bit and say, in comments, I was giving evidence to the Senate Committee on Aboriginal Peoples and was talking about our institutions and what we do. And I shared that, you know, our intention is to become a university. So my advice at the time was go look at the university, the Council of University and the National Council of Universities, and figure out what they want you to have to be a university. And it was Senator Sinclair who asked the clarifying question. He said, just let me get this straight. They advised you, an Indigenous institution, to go to a non-Indigenous process to be recognized as an Indigenous university. I said, yes. He said, okay. I got to wrap my head around that one. He said. So, interestingly enough now, with the legislation that we were able to see passed, there is an Indigenous accreditation process now that will be established. It's called the Indigenous Advanced Education Skills Council. And their primary focus is on quality assurance. So we'll be going forward to that council and saying, here's our conditions of practice, here's what we are as a university, this is what we expect to be considered in terms of university capacity. We have a unique idea of university. It's not what you would normally think of. We think of it from lifelong learning. So think more of it as the place of learning for the people. But the word university resonates with them. And so that's where we're headed. The days ahead, that's for sure. I know some people, when I talk about this, their eyes raise up and they go, really? An Indigenous university? Isn't there one out west? And yes, there is one out west. It's affiliated with a mainstream university. What we're proposing is a standalone university that would have its own Indigenous governance. So, viable, I just want to say, in terms of financially, I think it can be operated. We have 9 institutes across the country, and I think of those institutes, when they're ready, they can start to deliver university programs to the Indigenous University of Ontario, and there's no reason why not. In Ontario, last year, the Ontario Student Assistance Program was transformed, and the education grant was hugely expanded. That opens opportunity for students to be able to enroll like never before. We've seen the uptake among our own students applying for OSAP. So if we can expand our university offerings, then we're going to see even more involvement from the students. I have lots of stuff I want to say, but I'm just watching my time here. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up by saying I invite you to come to our institution. We do have two campuses. The one at Six Nations is where Deo Hahagi is located, and that's usually where we hold what we call our Champions for Change conference every year. This year we'll be hosting it again, and it's because it's our 25th year of operation, it's going to be more of a celebration as well. Sometimes it's very research focused, and sometimes it has other focus, but we'll make sure that you get information about that. Our other campus is in Brantford, as I said. It's really easy to get to. It's just off the 403, and that's where the STEAM Academy is. So if you would like to come and see that campus, I think you'd be pleased. The spirit of the Touro is very evident there. The student lounge is named the Touro Lounge. The lecture hall is called the White Pine Assembly Hall. The White Pine is the tree of peace in our culture. And the cafeteria is soon to be officially named All Nations Cafeteria. So, I mean, everything, every step, everything we do, we try to make sure that that thinking and that caring and that reciprocity exists in everything that we do. I'm just going to conclude by asking you to... I'm going to share one thing with you, and it's just an email that I received from a student. Well, she's now an employee. And it kind of wraps up the impact of what we do, and so it kind of repositions what Indigenous institutions can do, their unique capacity to do things. And when it relates to compassionate justice, I think her words will hit home with you. I received this just 2 days ago. She said, "I haven't had a chance to fully speak and express my gratitude for the opportunities that SNP has given me. You're a busy woman, so I'll try and keep this brief." She sees me running in the halls, right? "I've learned so much over the years working here as a summer student in the IKC, that's the Indigenous Knowledge Center, where I got to nerd out and indulge in our culture. My development officer intern role has excelled my confidence greatly in the business and communication worlds. And of course, the incredible opportunity to work with and be part of the Haudenosaunee Ambassador Program has been a truly life-changing experience in more ways than I can explain in this email." Now she's working full-time with STEAM. "So since working full-time with STEAM, I feel as I am starting on a new chapter in my life. And these students are truly an inspiring bunch who make me laugh on the daily and make me so proud of what SNP stands for. I know not everyone gets to see our STEAM kids on a daily basis, but I look forward to seeing them every day. Like any young adult or people in general, we have our ups and downs and lessons we may have yet to learn. However, for myself, the biggest takeaway is that our STEAM students recognize we truly care a great deal about them and their education. This parallels how I felt when I underwent my first year of university at SNP. She did the UP program. It's easy to recognize that our staff go above and beyond, sometimes unknowingly, to help others recognize their true potential. I remember talking with a colleague on day one of the STEAM orientation about how surreal it was to finally see students in seats. Not only were the students finally here, but they were from different walks of life, not just our own Gohonwe kids. I am incredibly proud of our students for how far they have come, and I'm excited for what the future has in store for them. SNP STEAM Academy is fostering compassionate, understanding, and innovative leaders of today and tomorrow, and I am incredibly thankful to be working alongside them." And this is from Kaylin Parker, one of our graduates. So with those words, I'll close. Thank you. I know it's time. Thank you.